All right, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. We'll go ahead and call this meeting to order. Can we get a roll call, please?
Alexander Evangelia Indian, City of Blythe.
Here.
City of Cathedral City.
Here.
City of Coachella.
Here.
Coachella Valley Water District. City of Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
Imperial Irrigation District. City of Indian Wells. City of India.
Present.
City of Boquita.
Present.
Mission Springs Water District.
Present.
City of Palm Desert.
Here.
City of Palm Springs.
Here.
City of Rancho Mirage.
Here.
Riverside County.
Here.
Torres Martinez, Desert Julia Indian. Chairman.
Thank you. And we'll move on to public comments on agenda items, and we'll hold off on any of the comments for the salt and compare with the item. Is there any other public comments that we have?
No, Chair, we have no public comments.
All right, thank you. Go ahead and move on to committee member and director comments. Do we have any other comments from our directors here? I just have a short report. This past week, I attended the Southern California Association of Governments Energy and Environment Committee. One project they're working on is the Clean Energy Compendium, which is going to be an online resource that will compile information on new and old technologies and equipment. That will make it easier for us to compare efficiencies and all costs associated with new technologies. Some statistics that they shared was, for 2022, 1.4 million zero-emission vehicles were sold in California. 18% of new vehicle sales were zero-emission vehicles. 71,000 level two charging stations were installed, and 8,500 level three fast charging stations were installed. The California Energy Commission is estimating that we'll need 1.2 million chargers by 2030. So we'll need to ramp up production on that pretty fast. And some recommendations they made was for cities to inventory all their EV infrastructure and set goals for 2030, and to pursue station development on city-owned properties and continue our fleet conversions. We also talked about population growth in California. The previous study in 2016 showed 19% growth in population over the next 30 years. That number is now down to 11%. Any comments on your end?
Yeah, I've got a couple to share. One is we would like to pull one item from the agenda. That is item 6D, the contract for used oil recycling. Got some procurement. We're going to probably do another procurement on that over the summer and bring it back to you in the fall. Secondly, committee member Betts has mentioned before some graffiti issues along I-10, and we know that's a persistent issue. We have talked to Caltrans and submitted a number of requests for cleanup. Caltrans is working on their aspect of it, and interchanges, it gets complicated. Some of that graffiti out there is Caltrans responsibility, some is city responsibility, some is county responsibility, depending on interchange. So we're gonna do our best to get the word out for the right agency when we know where that line is for each one of the interchanges. That work is underway, and you'll see on your agenda at the end, of course, we have our General Assembly at the end of the month, at the Canyon Parlor, Ranch Mirage on June 26th. And you all get per diems for participating in these meetings. For those that want direct deposit, please get your form, which I think was emailed to you. Sign it, give us a hard copy for our records. We'll make sure we get direct deposit payments to you. That's the extent of my comments.
Can I make a comment on what you said? So I have an EV, it's a Ford, and we've just been notified that we're going to be able to start using the Tesla chargers.
Oh, okay.
They're going to make, and doesn't that make all the sense in the world that all chargers should work for all vehicles? Because, you know, the money's only going to the person you're giving it to. It doesn't matter what station it is. Yeah. And that will open up so much charging if they will make those universal.
And was that part of some new legislation that required that?
Part of a Ford thing.
Because they are requiring Tesla's
Ford
already,
Tesla made it.
Mm-hmm. They're requiring them to be universal chargers now, right? Some of the new.
Well, so I definitely think they will just get an additional adapter. But it did, still did. I didn't think it was before. I'm sure we all have. But, you know, it just makes sense that all chargers should be available to all kinds of cars. It shouldn't be necessarily specific. They can still get the money, just the charging station should be specific.
We'll move on to Apple next.
All right, let's go.
It's a European standard. We have an EU standard that needs to be dealt with on a national level.
Good.
Mr. Chair, quick comment on EV chargers. Our city just had installation of 80 new EV charging stations.
Nice. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Wish we had that kind of power.
80.
Wish we had
80. Wow. I don't like where they're going, but.
Another note, Fisco Foods, I believe one of the biggest food distributors in the world, just launched their new EV program. It's going to be 800 tractors, trucks, right? Delivery trucks, some of them with refrigeration, and their hub, electric vehicle hub, is going to be in Riverside. So they're working on that now as well. Right, we'll move on to the consent calendar. Any questions?
Move approval, looking up. Second, Ranger Mark.
Right, we have a motion from Benita, second from Ranger Mark. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And then Bly?
Yes. Thank you.
You are no problem. Move on to our next item. We have a presentation on regional climate change trends and implications for resiliency from Dr. Lynn Sweet, UCR Center for Conservation Biology.
Hello, Chair Commissioner. Thank you for having me today. I've attended this meeting before, so thanks for letting me come talk a little bit about regional trends, climate change, and climate resiliency. I'm Dr. Lynn Sweet. I work for UC Riverside at the Center for Conservation Biology. I run a conservation biology lab where we do monitoring under the Global Species Plan. We also do habitat modeling and work on climate change issues with a variety of stakeholders. So I'm going to talk about regional trends of climate change today. Can I advance the slide or what it is? All right, fantastic. So again, thanks for having me. Just a quick look at some of the beautiful education and some of the new generation that we're already protecting with our efforts towards conservation, energy, and environment. So just in brief, you know, the U.S. Southwest is really threatened by climate change. This is Patrick Gonzalez, who works for the National Park Service at Berkeley. And his data has shown that the urban southwestern states have already experienced the darkest decline in precip in the contiguous 48 states. So that's something that we really have to have the stress, you know, we're in this region where we have a aridity is increasing. Also that, you know, it hasn't been this high for about 1300 years. So this is concerning and something that we need to work on. Again, this is explained because the CO2 levels we're seeing in the atmosphere are as high as 800,000 years. This added CO2 isotopically matches those fossil fuels that they're emitting, not natural sources. So, you know, the addition of those CO2 particles, you can actually tie them to human emissions. That higher CO2 levels, they do lead to higher temperatures. And any other factor trying to explain the rises in temperatures that I'm going to show you, only about 3% can be explained by any other natural cause. And again, I want to stress that I'm not a climatologist, I'm a conservation biologist, and a plant biologist, but I put together this information from various sources to present to you today. But I'm happy to follow up on any information that you want. So looking at the climate change scenarios, this was a graphic put out by UCR and other entities in the fourth regional climate assessment report for the Inland Desert. Some of you might have been at the rollout a couple years ago, just pre-pandemic at UC Riverside. So this shows the trends in temperature. This is in Fahrenheit on the y-axis. You can see a gray line, black line, showing regional annual max temperature from past to current. And then we have two future projections. So one line expands into 2100, showing a moderately mitigated scenario. This is known as a 4.5 scenario. Essentially, this is a standardized representation conservation pathway based on sort of global population, policy, economics, and energy use. So that's the moderate emissions pathway. And then we have the business as usual scenario. So that's looking at end of century maximum average temperatures in the inland deserts if we do not use this, the business as usual scenario. So hopefully we don't go that direction, but that's the basis of sort of the projections that I'm talking about that you see our downscale for this purpose. So thinking about our region, of course, this summary was produced for all the inland deserts, but this is, you know, the hottest and driest region in California. Our climate's becoming more extreme with daily high temperatures projected to increase about 8 to 14 degrees Fahrenheit by end of century. The rainfall rates are currently, low, as we know, about 5 inches per year. And they're really highly, of course, as you know, variable every year. Unfortunately, that variability is projected to increase towards the end of the century, with extreme drought and extreme wet events becoming more and more common. And we also might see increasing frequency of these events that increase the risk of flash flooding and wildfire. And I'll talk a bit more about those points in a moment. So looking at the change in temperature. So this is looking at the change in temperature from 1961, between 1961 and essentially the present. And this is looking at a difference in average daily maximum temperature. So we can see certain places are kind of heating up a little bit faster and certain places a little slower, but all of the places are heating up. So this is showing their red areas have heated up about 0.7 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's already what we're seeing. And then looking at the future, this Inland Deserts Report also produced these graphics, I think, which are really readable and accessible to the public, showing something like snowbird season, because that's something where they're concerned about, looking at what is the temperature in snowbird season. We have two graphs. The one on the left shows the average temperature in Indio during snowbird season. And that's on the bottom, we see a trend throughout the year for historic. So that's the line that we usually see, that black line at the bottom. With that moderately mitigated, we might see that blue line for a temperature trend. And then we go all the way up to that red, that red line at the top for mid-century. Towards end of century, it gets a little bit even higher. So you can see those peaks at the beginning and the end of that graph there, they're reaching towards almost 100. So we do see a bit of a difference in the different scenarios we're looking at. And when we look at rainfall, that's something that's really relevant, I think, to things that you're thinking about, rainfall patterns and infrastructure in the valley for this committee. Over most of the region, the wettest day of the year is projected to increase by as much as 30% in some areas by 2100. The other thing is the summer monsoon, and those monsoon precipitation might decrease up to 40%, but there are various models that for precipitation especially is hard to predict. So we'll keep an eye on especially in the future trying to bracket the predictions and looking at the wet predictions and also the dry predictions. But overall, sort of the average is a decrease in monsoonal flow. Winter precipitation is predicted to increase over the region. Due to the warming of the tropical Pacific. So that's something we need to again keep an eye on with measurements and also using the most up-to-date climate models. Overall, is the variability. We already have variability in the desert year to year and precipitation. That increased variability over time will lead to a challenge, I think. Extreme drought and extreme wet events becoming more and more common. And really this in that changing water availability is really important for plants, for animals, all species we conserve, and the CDC, CBMS, HCP, but also for agricultural systems as well in the valley. So something we need to think about. Also, relevant to this committee, I think, is the winds. So of course, and you might have had experts talk about, changes in wind speeds in the past and future. From this report, the synthesis was that the models predicted maybe subtle changes in wind speeds. But it's really hard to pin down because when you get in winds, you're actually talking about weather, and those are entirely different models. Those are dynamical models that produce predictions of weather. We're talking more about climate, so that's the best that you can do at the moment. Is we might see a little bit of an increase in wind speed. If you look at the facts, desert winds are driven by differences, and if we have increases in temperature, we might see increases in wind speed as well. But again, as pointed out in the report. Further research is needed there. And one of the implications, as we know, this is important to maintain those sand-driven ecosystems that we want to protect for the finch-toed lizard and other species. Those rely on those sand corridors and a steady set of sand inflow. Of course, it's a major factor in the population of wildfire, which we have to think about for our mountains and maybe increasingly in the low desert, as well. And it's a major economic factor, as we know, in energy production. It has to do with air quality, especially, and salt and sea issues. So So wind is something that I think is really important that we figure out, you know, what might happen and do something about it. Because we don't want these days, we want something that looks a little bit more like this, our beautiful Coachella Valley. So moving on to why California's deserts matter. It's a really important region actually for carbon storage. It's a really dry arid climate, so it actually stores carbon really well. Of course, renewable resources, abundant sunshine, you know, the mandatory sun, as you know. And we have our beautiful Colorado desert vegetation. So we are in a really biodiverse region. It's really special. Of course, we work really hard to conserve these lands and study them to make sure that we are kind of accurate reflection of what's happening. In our Coachella Valley, we have some awesome communities, the sand dune communities that support the produce of lizards and other types. The desert scrub predominates over the valley, also protects the desert tortoise. And then we have our salt sink communities as well. So what we're doing as UCR is actually to look at ways we can see what might happen to these vegetation types over time. Some might be more resilient and some a little bit less resilient. And just to point out how important the desert is, up to 10% of the carbon sequestration in California is in the desert. We have this really large pool of carbon that is derived from these biological processes. This carbon's patchy and deep. We really want to work on keeping it there. That's kind of the message. We have this large pool of stored sea carbon, and it has that potential to be lost with disturbance. So looking at that, just thinking about how do we protect that carbon. Remember, we do have surface disturbance that can lead to things like that process of burying the carbon from the plant roots down in, that stops. The lichens aren't stabilizing soil surface, we might have increase in dust. Soil erodes, exposes that carbon, and then crystals dissolve, and then you lose that carbon. So it's actually really counterproductive to have that land clearing if it's not necessary, and it's better to sort of keep that intact and keep our carbon pump, putting that carbon back into the soil. So at UCR, we're working on a bunch of projects. We work with, again, the MSHCP on projects. We are also working with the Coachella Valley Mountains Conservancy under the CNRA to try to provide this kind of information to decision makers and the public. So that's bolstering community resilience. So our goal there is to look at where is carbon stored? How will the vegetation change? How can we prevent that carbon loss? And then what information do you need so that I can provide you with, you know, information you can use for decision making? Again, that project also encompasses community resilience, teaching the public about the environment and climate change helps them understand and be able to respond to the issues that we're facing. We have various partnerships there for communication outreach. And the goal is really to, oh, I see something familiar in this photo. There's the chair in the bottom left photo doing some outreach with us. That I think this project pairs really well with the monitoring we do by the MSHCP. So this one is focused more on community engagement and outreach, which is fantastic. So we do a lot of outreach to tell the public about what we do. And then we do have these research partnerships, again, to do climate change predictions and other measurements and modeling. We have a variety of partners for that. So overall, just we're trying to provide information that can help with forecasting and climate shifts for conservation and the environment. We work to test these in the field, but the predictions are only as good as, you know, how much we can sort of prove what's happening based on the data. If, you know, if we're seeing that, you know, what might happen, or if we're seeing data that's indicating something else is happening. That's our challenge. And looking at the remaining suitable habitat for species. So we want to protect that species and also understand where they might have habitat in the future. We did so with Joshua trees. Climate change overall will have really a significant impact on our lives and the places we love. So, and that's what I have.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sweet, for your work in this area. You know, really helps us in our education, not only for our kids, but for our policy makers here. So we really appreciate all your hard work on these items. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, well, thanks. So we've got countries like China that are gross polluters. Are they impacting our desert?
So our desert is subject to, you know, to the global climate, you know, the global climate. So yes, anyone emitting, you know, CO2 is impacting our climate.
So you're UCR, right?
Yes.
So UCR looking at maybe advocating for policies that would encourage China to reduce its emissions, and I guess we're having huge impacts to our standard of living here with the costs of what we're trying to do to clean up what's already a relatively clean environment here in the U.S. compared to other worlds, other parts of the world. Are you working towards that? Because, I mean, we could save 1% here, and they just dwarf it with what they're putting out.
It's, yeah, that is where you come in. So that's yeah, true. As we don't do any advocacy for policy, but we try to provide that information, which is why I think that fourth annual Inland Desert Summit was really helpful, because it was meant for policymakers and the public to take that information and move with it, you know, in the direction they need.
So let me bring this local to my last question here, and not wanting to miss an opportunity. Does the continually exposure of the salt and sea and possible disturbance of that, is that leading to a threat to greenhouse gas emissions once the water's gone?
That's actually something that we'll be looking at in our climate resilience project. We're going to be looking at the storage of carbon across the valley and what those look like based on, you know, soil mapping and sampling. So we'll find that out. I couldn't say anything right now, but it could be that there is significant carbon stored in that area.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you. Any other questions for our presenter? No other questions? Thank you so much for your presentation. Next item, we have 6B update on Colorado River negotiations from Christopher Harris, the Executive Director of the Colorado River Board.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm the chairman of the committee. This item relates as a follow-up to your interest on negotiations regarding the Colorado River. We've heard from River Irrigation District Director J.B. Hamby on ongoing negotiations. There has been a short-term deal and recently struck between federal government and the lower water basin states, as well as support from the upper basin states. And with us today is Chris Harris, who's the director of the Colorado River Basin, and give you an update on the recent agreement that was negotiated. Chris, the floor is yours. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Yeah, as Director Hamby said, we've been hard at work with our colleagues in the other six Colorado River Basin states over going on 18 months now, trying to come up with solutions both for the short term and the long term, looking at stabilizing the conditions of both Lakes Powell and Meade. And it's been a tough 18 months. The drought has continued, we're going on virtually 23 years now of continuous drought in the Colorado River Basin, and that's made discussions very difficult and challenging among the seven basin states in the United States. But with the good hydrology that we got this winter, and one good season does not break a drought for sure, but we really doubled down on our discussion with our colleagues in Arizona and Nevada and among California's Colorado River water users. And we did reach an agreement in late May on how to operate the Colorado River system over the next 3.5 years. And that's going to give us an opportunity then to redouble our efforts at working collaboratively with the other six basin states to develop long-term guidelines for the Colorado River system that need to be in place as of January 1, 2027. And the framework that we put together in late May that was agreed upon between the three lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada, and by the United States, would involve undertaking activities and programs, particularly in Arizona and in California, that would result in the conservation of an additional 3 million acre feet of Colorado River water over the next 3.5 years. So 2023, 24, 25, and 2026. And that conservation, in conjunction with the reductions in water use that are being implemented under the existing 2007 interim shortage guidelines, and the drought contingency plan, as well as our binational agreement with our partners in Mexico, Minute 323, could result in about 6 million acre feet of conserved water supplies being retained in the reservoir system. And that combined with the good hydrology we got this winter is likely to help stabilize the reservoir system and give us now the ability to kind of turn our attention to the long-term negotiation of guidelines for post-2026. And if I don't know if any of you are aware, but in October of 2022, California's Colorado River water users agreed to develop an additional 400,000 acre feet of water use reductions each year for the same period, 23 through 26. And that 1.6 million acre feet is the contribution that we will be making as California towards this interim period deal. Now, Reclamation, the Bureau of Reclamation and the Department of the Interior are in the process right now of evaluating the term sheet that we presented them on May 22nd that framed out this agreement between Arizona, California, and Nevada. And they're going to evaluate it in a draft supplemental environmental impact statement and see how well it performs at protecting critical elevations in both Lakes Powell and Meade. And in the meantime, California and Arizona's Colorado River water users who will be participating in this program are also working with the Bureau of Reclamation to finalize contractual agreements to actually conserve these water supplies under funding that's being made available through the Inflation Reduction Act and potentially some from the bipartisan infrastructure law. And so the process over this summer and into the fall will be to finalize those conservation agreements with the Bureau of Reclamation, get the funding flowing, actually have the agricultural districts and the municipal districts who are participating begin implementing these water conservation programs and continue to do so each year over the next 4 years through the end of 2026. We also anticipate that the Department of the Interior will be releasing a notice in the Federal Register sometime this month, potentially next week, but sometime in June, indicating that they are going to be kicking off a formal NEPA process under the National Environmental Policy Act to begin developing the next set of operating guidelines for the post-2026 framework. In other words, the long-term guidelines that will replace the 2007 guidelines. And that's kind of pretty much where we are right now. It's been, like I said, a long 18 months now working with our colleagues in the other states. But I think we've got a foundation now that we can build upon. The states are working well together now, better than we had been, say, 6 months ago. So I think all of us remain cautiously optimistic that we can do the good work that needs to be done over the next few months and next three and a half years, getting us to a longer term set of guidelines that can help stabilize the reservoir system over the long term. Maybe I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Harris. And one question I have, you know, you mentioned the 400,000 acre feet from October 2022, and now the current 1.6 million acre feet. Is that 400,000 acre feet included in the 1.6 million, or is that separate?
Yeah, the 400,000 acre feet each year on average, totaling 1.6 million acre feet, is part of this term sheet that we put together. It's California's contribution that helps get us to the total 3 million acre feet of additional water conservation we'd be doing in this remaining interim period. That is on top of the existing obligations for water use reductions that are already in place based upon the 2007 guidelines and the 2019 drought contingency plans.
And then it was my understanding that those 400,000 acre feet that are being held back every year, is that only for agriculture, or is that going to be municipalities or?
Yeah, it involves the urban sector as well. Metropolitan has a role in that, both through their fallowing program they have with Palo Verde Irrigation District. They have a program with the Fort Yuma Kitsan Indian Tribe and also with the Bard Water District. And it also includes some water that they will be, because of the good hydrology this year and the ample state water project supplies, it's very likely that Metropolitan will be leaving additional water in Lake Mead just because they won't need to pull it off because they've got enough coming from the state water project. So it involves all of California's Colorado River water users.
And I know we have Jim Barrett from CBWD here to talk about maybe some of the potential local impacts. Bill, like to share any?
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Ortiz. Great, good to see you again, members of the committee, CWD staff, or not CWD, the CBAG staff. Slight slip of the tongue there. So the question I was asked is, what is CWD's participation in this plan? We actually started last year, and we have got an agreement that's in its final draft form now. With reclamation, although it has not been signed, we'll be bringing it to our board at our next meeting on Tuesday. CDWD, while there's tension between the different parts of the community, urban municipalities, ag, what we have attempted to do is to minimize the impact locally by not proposing to curtail service to anybody that's currently using water now. What we've done, what we did starting last year was to suspend our replenishment operations in the East Valley at the Thomas Levy replenishment facility. We have got three facilities that we manage ourselves, and then another one that we manage with collaboratively with Desert Water Agency. We're fortunate, as Chris had mentioned, there Metropolitan is the only other district besides CBWD that has water delivery contracts with both the federal government, Colorado River, and the state water project. Our deliveries in the lower valley to the Levy facility have been pretty consistent over time because the Colorado River water deliveries have been consistent over time. We have put in about 500,000 acre feet since 2010, we actually started a pilot project out there in the late 1990s. But we're averaging between 35,000 and 38,000 acre feet per year. What we're doing moving forward is suspending 35,000 acre feet each year to leave in Lake Mead. We'll still have about 3,000 that we run through the plant to keep the pumps from ceasing. But that's it in a nutshell. Continuing because of the hydrology, we're also very fortunate that we're taking deliveries now at Whitewater. Deliveries there have not been as consistent in the west side of the valley because it depends on the hydrology in Sierra Nevada. But because of agreements we have with Metropolitan, we expect that we'll probably receive over 300,000 acre feet this year. We're receiving over 720 cubic feet per second now. So if you can imagine, a cubic foot is about the size of a basketball in a box. 720 of those coming at you every second is a pretty good flow. We will be watching to see how conditions in the East Valley change during this period. It's important to us to recognize how the basin responds, both not only to replenishment, but the suspension of replenishment. We do have a rather large expansion of our irrigation system in the East Valley for agriculture that's just about done. We're waiting on an idea to do the power drops so we can get our pumps moving. And that should help with some of the replenishment that would otherwise be occurring through the Levy facility. We estimate about 30 to 35% return flow to the aquifer from irrigation that takes place for agriculture. We're putting about 260 to 280,000 acre feet per year on agricultural irrigation in East Valley. So if there are questions, I'd be happy to take those now, but that would conclude my remarks.
Thank you. And so the 35,000 acre feet that you mentioned that are being spent, that's only at the East Valley facility?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Question.
Yeah, thanks. So as I've watched the different water district meetings recently, I watched yours, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is you had a meeting not long ago that said, hey, we've just determined that the water levels in our wells are up significantly, and so we're suspending some of the drought requirements of the drought steps being taken towards the drought.
The tier penalties?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah,
So that's a different, I mean, it probably might be a connection you could make.
Well, I guess my point is the water levels that you saw that I understood from your meeting is the water levels are way up, the groundwater levels.
Well, we have seen the water levels in the East Valley rise about 30 to 75 feet, depending on where you are in the East Valley. Since 2010. So we would consider that to be an indicator that the replenishment is working. And depending on where you are in the valley, that measurement will change because the water as it comes in tends to create a mound that then moves downward to the salt sea. So it's a very transitory condition. And at least in the West, where our deliveries are much more dependent on an inconsistent hydrology, there's been times when there's been no water coming into the West.
Yeah, so I tell you, you watch Cal ISO and how they try and manage electricity, and then you think about the job that you guys are all doing just to keep water flowing in the right direction. That's amazing.
But you can store water. It's hard to store electrons.
Yeah, well, I still think you've got a tough job. Just one quick question for Mr. Parrott. So your projections on this meeting, on the usage was that you're using some type of modeling that says we're going to be in a continued drought, or that we don't know. What modeling did you use to set up those agreements?
Yeah, typically what we utilize, we rely upon the Bureau of Reclamation's modeling team. They've got a very good, high caliber group of folks up in Boulder, Colorado, as well as in Boulder City, Nevada, who coordinate Colorado River operations and activities and also help us with long-term strategic planning. And they have a proprietary set of models that they've developed for the Colorado River Basin. And we utilize that. Now, some of us have in-house capability. I'm not implying by any stretch of the imagination that we know that the drought's going to continue. All we're trying to do is look at potential worst case hydrologies and various scenarios to ensure that both from an operations perspective and also from a water supply and demand perspective that we're taking into account situations similar to what we've been going through, potentially some that could worsen over time. And we're using that to help us come up with potential programs and activities such as what Jim Barrett just outlined that Coachella Valley Water District is involved in. It kind of takes that all of us working together as a village, if you will, to come up with potential schemes and solutions that could be applied over both the short term as well as the longer term. I hope that's helpful.
Last question, just to understand the negotiations took place. If at this time next year, we're seeing the same type of rainfall, and then the year after that, is everything that you just went through going to change? And somebody's going to say, well, we have way more than enough water now, or what do you see the projection?
Well, and Jim, I think, would probably agree with me on this. Given that right now we've got a combined reservoir system that is something between 25 and 30% of capacity, it's probably a bit early to declare victory. If we had 3 or 4 or 5 years of what we just had this winter, both in the Sierra system as well as in the Colorado River Basin, it would certainly alleviate a lot of the pressure and angst that many of us are going through right now. But I think, you know, what we've been seeing with the Colorado River system of late is we'll have a good year, like what we just went through. 2011 is another example. And then it's followed up by 3 years of pretty miserable hydrology. We definitely helped the reservoir system this year, and we're taking advantage of that. And that was part of the impetus for this three lower basin state effort, working closely with the feds in putting this agreement together, this short-term agreement, was we wanted to take advantage of this good hydrology. And having the ability in California now to take advantage of the good hydrology from the Sierra system really helped us a lot this year. Jim just went through what Coachella's doing, and boy, they really forward leaned into this. But it, you know, we'd sure love to have a year or two more like that, but we're certainly not betting on it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr.
Chair? Mr. Chair, I have one question. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for your presentation as well, Jim. And maybe between both of you, you might be able to share some information on this. And we've been talking about the South Sea today quite a bit with our earlier conservation meeting and how this one eventually we're going to talk about it as well. Has there been any thoughts or what's the analysis as to how this is going to impact the South Sea through the study that you're going to be conducting, and what does that talk look like, or what are you hearing, or what might be coming our way that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, if I could, Chris, Supervisor, I think you're aware, the Salton Sea Authority is aware that there has been a study conducted by the Bureau of Reclamation, and that study did not consider impacts to the Salt Sea. CBWD is not doing a study. I don't believe the California board is doing a study. So it is something, I think if you think back to shortly after I got here, under the QSA, the Quantification Settlement Agreement that was signed in 2003, IID had the responsibility to deliver water, mitigation water to the sea. And there was a period there, I think it was probably 2010 or 11, where they actually had an underrun and were able to make an advanced delivery of about 44,000 acre feet. The Bureau of Reclamation objected to that. And it basically took IID about 10 years to repay the system for water that would have otherwise been scheduled to go to the sea. The issue is Reclamation got so much feedback from the other basin states that was an inappropriate delivery. And Reclamation actually came out and said the sea has no right to Colorado River water. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of the projects that take place down there have to find an alternative source of water and cannot just tap the Colorado River. I think the water that IID is using for their species habitat conservation is actually water that's already been beneficially used for agriculture and then comes down through the rivers and drains to be put to a second use as part of this habitat restoration. That's the same type of solution that I think Wade Crowfoot has put in place for the North Lake Demonstration Project, where the plan right now, as I understand it, is to try and capture drain water that comes off of CBWD's agricultural drains and also through the stormwater channel to then divert that over to be used for the North Lake project. I know Reclamation has also signed up on that deal with Wade, IID, and CBWD, but there's this hard nut that has to be cracked as to whether or not the sea has a right to Colorado River water, and then having the other basin states see that right as well.
Thank you. Any thoughts on your end, Ms. Harris?
I would only add, as Jim just alluded to, in December of 2022, there was a comprehensive memorandum of understanding that was entered into between IID, CVWD, and the Bureau of Reclamation in the state of California. And there is an acknowledgement that in undertaking this additional up to 400,000 acre feet each year over the next 4 years through 2026, that there could be additional impacts to the sea. And the federal government has stepped up and said that they will help fund additional activities and analyses and so forth that are needed. But I think Jim laid out a fair portrayal of where we are right now in trying to manage additional water conservation activities and mitigate additional impacts to the Salton Sea.
I guess I would just ask that for future meetings with the Bureau of Reclamation and others that are engaged in this whole Colorado River water issue, that some way, somehow, the Salton Sea, the impacts of the Salton Sea is integrated into that conversation, if it's at all possible. Because we have to really consider potentially the negative impacts as a result of what's happening with the Colorado River on the Salton Sea and the health concerns of our folks that live not only around the Salton Sea but the entire Coachella Valley and Imperial County for that matter.
Yeah. Right. Good point. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Thank you, Mr. Barry, for your comments. Appreciate it. Okay. And now we're going to move on to item 16, Senate Bill 583, the People of the Ecology Conservancy. Everyone, Len Martinez.
Good afternoon, Chairman of the Committee. This is a nice segue to this further discussion issue related to the Salton Sea, which is part of the Colorado River Basin. We are monitoring and have a recommendation for Bill SB 583, offered by our Senator Bahia, co-authored by our Assemblyman Eduardo Garcia. Nice postcard, Salton Sea there. As mentioned, Salton Sea is part of the basin. You can see there, I'll give you a quick highlights of events. 1905, there was a water breach canal, wildlife refuge in 1930, 1999, big fish die-off, QSA, which is direct water transfer, they're staying within both on both the anchor people sign, 8.9 billion sticker shock, which is preferred alternative, IID, and they have Kelly, IID for United Chicken, continued projects in 2015, a task force was set up under the Department Administration, and subsequently covering new sub-established the Salton Sea Management Program, phase one tanker plan. The bill before us, SB 583, established a conservancy. Conservancies are made to protect and serve and provide outdoor recreation access. Give you quick highlights of what the bill does. It establishes a Salton Sea Conservancy, undertake projects, specifically the tanker plan and the long range plan, allows them to award and receive grants to implement those projects, coordinate the local agencies and stakeholders on said projects, and also establishes a governing board that's comprised of 8 members, 3 by the state, 5 that are local members of the board that are specifically tribes, local governments, and environmental justice groups, to also long-range planning and legal challenges ahead. And then it, along with all the other conservancies that are existing, would fall under the California Natural Resources Agency. Some of the concerns related to this bill that have been raised by stakeholders here locally relate to the transfer of projects and programs from the California Natural Resources Agency to a new conservancy, and what that would do to the experience, skill, knowledge they gain, what would it do to the projects that are being implemented, such as the native vegetation project that is underway, as well as the species conservation habitat project, and ultimately the momentum that has been gained so far with IAP, this momentum by creating our conservancy. Furthermore, the conservancy will overlap with the Coachella Valley Moses Conservancy jurisdictional boundary, as well as with the Desert Conservation Program boundary. Very high level, those are some of the concerns we do have. To impose recommendation, that about the water district, we just that line of comment, so I'll read those at the appropriate time. But I will turn it over to Dan Reeves, who's the chief of staff for IDEA's office, to give you his perspective as to why they're advocating for this measure. And then following Mr. Reeves, we have Patrick Woodhouse. So, Dan Reeves.
Thank you, Manuel, and I appreciate your offer to allow me to make a presentation regarding SB 583. And I apologize if some of this is repetitive to some of the participants, since I testified at the previous committee hearing as well. It is fascinating to have listened to the discussion around the Colorado River agreement that was recently agreed to. And of course, it's going to have a major impact on the Salton Sea. And therefore, the crisis that we're facing at the seas is not going to slow, it's going to accelerate. And everyone, we all know that. And certainly, this is not the time for standing pat and following the status quo. We need to take significant new steps in order to stem this crisis. And that is the reason why SB 583 was introduced, to create the Salton Sea Conservancy. A conservancy has multiple advantages that would help the state deliver unprecedented support to the sea and its surrounding communities. Primarily, it would offer three central advantages over what's currently done. The first, conservancies are free of many of the ordinary budgetary constraints on state agencies. And as a result, they can operate in a more nimble fashion, move money faster, and make decisions quicker. On top of that, they are free of much of the red tape that frequently handcuffs state agencies. And therefore, they can deliver projects faster. So not only can they move money faster, spend money faster, they can deliver projects faster. And I would simply point to the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy in its past couple of decades and its breathtaking expansion of preserved habitat underneath that conservancy. Second, the conservancy would be governed by a board of local stakeholders, the majority of which would be local government representatives, giving communities surrounding the sea for the first time a direct say in how state resources are prioritized and allocated, something that's not done currently, given that the state natural resources agencies Salton Sea Management Program is governed and controlled by Sacramento bureaucrats. We're all doing a very good job. However, they operate in Sacramento, and we think that decision-making ought to be at the sea itself. Finally, the Conservancy would, for the first time, create an on-the-ground state and local partnership that would manage and protect the properties that have been stitched together by the Conservancy to manage those properties and maintain those properties in perpetuity. And I want to repeat this piece because currently there's no one on the ground, and Supervisor Perez knows this as well, that is willing to take on the responsibility of managing these properties in perpetuity, let alone a state and local controlled conservancy that can do it for an ongoing basis. And that's something that cannot be underestimated, because these projects, if we do not have the means to manage them in perpetuity, they will dry up and disappear after a few years, if not decades. So as many of you know, we're facing a significant budget crisis. The governor and his May revise proposed to withdraw $169 million that had been previously designated for the sea, suggesting that money ought to come from a climate bond that would be later negotiated by the legislature and put on the ballot for the voters to vote on. So we are clearly at a very critical juncture for the sea and its health and for the public health of the surrounding communities. I want to emphasize one other thing, and that is SB 583 would have no impact on ongoing efforts at the sea, nor would it have any impact on any local governmental authority, including the Salton Sea Authority, which is not impacted by this bill. Instead of waging a fight against state support and increasing that support for the sea, or waging a fight against local control over those state resources, we clearly have to come together and work very diligently now to make sure that whatever bond is negotiated, it maximizes resources for the Salton Sea, and that whatever resources are dedicated to the sea, that there be local control and input on how those resources are prioritized and spent. And finally, I would like to make one more point, and that is the Salton Sea Authority, who's asked for this opposition, have argued that there'd be duplication of efforts at the sea with this bill, suggesting or at least implying that the Salton Sea Authority will depart from its current set of responsibilities and missions to actually launching its own efforts around projects and then maintaining those projects, essentially stepping into the shoes of the Natural Resources Agency to deliver projects and manage those projects. And that is something I can tell you with absolute certainty, California State Department of Finance would love to turn over that responsibility and that liability over to the local JPA at the Salton Sea Authority. But I want to emphasize one thing. I want to make it very, very clear that Senator Padilla will fight aggressively any effort to alleviate the state, of its responsibilities and liability under current legal agreements, binding agreements to the Salton Sea. Right now, the Conservancy would absorb the Governor Newsom's Salton Sea Management Program. That staff would be rolled into the Conservancy, and then you would have a governing board controlled by local government entities. That is something that is currently not available to you, and that it, through the Conservancy, would grant you greater nimbleness and flexibility to get projects done faster, which is something that clearly is desperately needed at the sea right now. So with that, I would be happy to take any questions you might have, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you.
I think we have a few comments, and then we'll go into the questions. Next, we have Patrick O'Dowd from the Salton Sea Authority.
And most. And again, I appreciate the comments from the senator's office, and I'm clear that there are many, many things that we agree on. I think we understand what the problems, plural, are. I think the challenge is how we address those problems. There are opportunities within the framework of this piece of legislation to address perhaps some of those problems. But the Salton Sea Authority, which was formed 30 years ago and has provided local governance to 10 elected officials from 5-member agencies, all with adjacencies to the sea and impacts on the sea, have been working on this issue diligently over the last 10 years. Myself having been involved over the last 8 years, the first 6 as an elected director and last 2 as the executive director. I did want to pivot a little bit. Because of the immediately preceding conversation about some of the things that the authority is engaged in for the benefit of the community. It is true that, in fact, with the supplemental environmental impact statement for the negotiations on the Colorado River does not include an assessment of the impacts at the Salton Sea. And we didn't hear today that the new supplemental impact will include that either. The authority and its member agencies have been focused like a laser, working with the state and working with the federal government to create a framework that would allow us to understand what those impacts would be like. On a conventional situation, this would take a long time to underwrite, but time doesn't allow us that. We are facilitators to help the state and the water managers come to a critically important and time-sensitive solution. Another issue that we're working on in the immediate is in December of last year, we signed a feasibility study agreement with the federal government and the state of California, which allows for an analysis of the state's completed long-range plan. And after the 3-year study, we'll produce a project which, when deemed feasible by the Chief of the Corps, will be eligible for 65% federal match. Now, I understand the benefit of refining the state's responsibility, but right now that work's being done by the Salton Sea Management Plan, which is a combination of the Department of Water Resources, which rebuilt the Oroville Dam while it was failing, the California Natural Resources Agency and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I think the state has the assets and capability to implement solutions at the sea. The SSNP, the SDH project, if you haven't seen it, you should tour it. 4,000 acre wetlands project that was funded by $200 million that the Salton Sea Authority played no small part in advocating for, along with the $30 million that was secured both from the New River and the North Lake Demonstration Project, was implemented under contract by private contractors. So the notion that the state is actually going to be driving bulldozers out there is just kind of a misconception. The state will continue, has, and will continue to implement its 10-year plan. It's already 5 years through that plan, but before this conservancy can be fully implemented, it'll be substantially completed. And the feasibility study, which is really an underwriting of the state's long-range plan, will be halfway through its completion also. So this only demonstrates why we believe these are important issues being raised, but the time is not right to implement this well-intended but problematic solution. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. O'Dowd. And then we have comments from CBWD and IID. Next, right?
Yeah, how about we let IID representative the person, and I'll read the comments from somebody who's in there.
Okay, sounds good. Mr. Ortega?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Hi, good afternoon, Chairman Ortiz, members of the committee, Antonio Ortega, IID Government Affairs. Unfortunately, Director Karen Eugenio cannot join you for your meeting today. She is actually in Boulder, Colorado, accompanied by IID Director J.B. Hamby. As you heard throughout the day today, Colorado River is very important. A lot of moving parts today, so they cannot be here to attend the meeting. However, they did ask me to provide some comments and IID's perspective on SB 583. So as everyone here is aware, to say that this is a priority for the district is an understatement. We are a signatory to the QSA. We have mitigation requirements on IID for air quality mitigation, managed marsh that we have at the foot of the Salton Sea. So it was IID that went to the State Water Board in 2016 when we requested the revised water order that gave way to the Salton Sea Management Program. So this is front and center for the IID and the comments that I would like to provide today. Although I believe that the committee and the staff did an excellent job providing a recommendation, I would like to propose something a little bit different. It gets us to the same place, but considering a support if amended position on the bill. I heard the Conservation Commission meeting earlier, and I know that there are continued concerns about some of the nuances of the bill, maybe making some tweaks to the language. IID agrees. Our legislative committee will be recommending to our full board at their next meeting a support if amended position on SB 583. We believe there are tweaks that we can make to the bill. Senator Padilla's office has been very receptive in our conversations. We believe that we're very close. This bill has passed the Senate with unanimous support. Not one no vote on this bill has taken place. So again, I think there is that willingness on the other side to meet together with the locals. Let's work together. A support if amended position gets us to the same place. We're taking a slightly different approach, not to oppose a bill, but if Senator Padilla, once we provide our comments, our amendments, does not accept them, then I believe that we should oppose a bill. However, this is an opportunity for us to allow them to do that. Show us. Dan Reeves provided an excellent presentation today. If in fact there is that willingness to come together, I think we could get to that place where we support the bill. And if we don't, then okay, I think we would agree that it's time to oppose a bill. But we would ask that the committee consider that alternative option, a support if amended position on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ortega.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair. Continuing on the comments that are in the bill, Chalai Water District did note here that her concerns relate to the impact of the work that Salt and Sea Authority is doing to recover preventative efforts, confusion over the role of the Conservancy, for instance, nearly identical emissions of the Salt and Sea Authority, and how those two agencies would interact, and also conflicting issues regarding water quality. Specifically, the bill says that the New Mexico Conservancy would improve water quality in and around the Salton Sea, but that would, of course, be difficult because there's multiple water agencies and IADs to be able to on water quality issues. And as I mentioned in my presentation, overlap with the jurisdictional overlap with the Chattahoochee Mountains Conservancy as well as with the other conservancy. In addition to that, I just want to let you know for the record that in addition to CPWD opposing and the Salt and Sea Authority, Salt and Sea Action Commission, Action Committee, Supervisor Perez, the U.S. Desert Review Indians are registered in opposition to the bill in the latest analysis and in support. We have Yansac and Chattahoochee Valley Health Law in California, City of Bali, Complete Design, Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, the Chair of the Water Foundation. And that concludes my report. And happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. Have a great presentation. And we'll have, we'll move on to commissioner comments. Supervisor, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll start us off and I'll try not to be repetitive. Although there are a few folks that have potentially did not hear the conversation that took place earlier. And obviously we are at a critical juncture. I agree with Dan on that. Colorado River cutbacks, the lack of state funding potentially coming our way as well. But I want to be clear on this, folks, that we're not trying to wage a war or a fight here. What we're trying to do is facilitate a conversation in which there is true coordination and consultation with the locals. Obviously, the Salton Sea Authority does not wish to take on the liability or be on the hook as the state stated years back that it would, and it still has not fulfilled its obligations. Although I would suggest that over the last 5 to 10 years, I've seen a major shift, more so than when I was in the state legislature. And there was a major lack of any type of momentum back in those days. And now there is a governor and as well a secretary in Mr. Wade Crowfoot that is very open and has visited us many times to the ideas of us ensuring that we mitigate, we do everything possible to restore the sea to the utmost. And I think Dan is correct. This is not about the status quo. This is about being transformative, finally. And if we're able to sit at the table as one, as was mentioned earlier, in unity, and work with each other as we should be, and not be a top-down approach, but rather bottom-up approach, I will definitely support that type of effort. I think up until now, and the reason I had to write an opposition letter was because I was not getting anywhere and not able to have a conversation to better understand why a legislation to create a conservancy and all the questions that were already raised and many more that still need to be addressed. And so ultimately, my hope is through this type of support for the recommendation, which is opposition, that it will force us all to sit down at the table, to think through what is the future of the Salton Sea Authority, what is the future of this conservancy. How do we draw down the monies? What are the monies actually land? What projects should be priority or future projects? How do we complete the North Lake pilot project? How do we ensure that the West Shores project gets completed as well? How do we ensure that the SCH projects on the south end, the species conservation habitat projects on the south end of the sea are finally completed as well, and so on and so forth. But those conversations have not taken place, and if they have, I have not been part of them. And so I like to make sure that ultimately we do have a voice and we do sit down at the table and we aren't status quo, as was mentioned. We're not waging a fight. This isn't about the locals having the liability. And this is ultimately about how we can work together so that there isn't duplication and that we are efficient and effective with these limited resources that we have. I'll stop there. There's more to be said, but I've already presented earlier, and I'm hoping that people understand where I'm coming from.
Thank you, Supervisor. Just some notes, I did make quite a few phone calls yesterday and talked to some of the leaders in the Solvency Authority. I did reach out to Senator Padilla's office, was not able to make contact there. But you know what it seems like there's still many conversations that need to be had with our senator and our current authority. Some of the questions that came up, will the Conservancy really be able to bring new money and streamline the state approval process from the state when we already have a direct relationship between this, the authority and the Natural Resources Agency? So we need to have that conversation with our current authority and our senator. The projects to add the solvency already require the state approvals from the agencies proposed in the Conservancy. So putting them all in the same room might actually be helpful, but it might not change the process. What process changes do we have there? Some other questions, what will be the differences in scope between the Solvency Authority and the new Conservancy? Right now, these two overlap. In my opinion, they overlap a lot in the way the bill is written. One question, who will handle operations and maintenance of the projects? This sounds like there's a need for that, and the Conservancy could fill that role. But currently, the bill gives the Conservancy a lot more power than just that. Some other issues, you know, building a new government board completely separate from the current board, which is already making progress with the 10-year management plan and the Army Corps of Engineers study, might not be beneficial for us here. So I think, you know, possibly there's a lot of compromises that could happen here. There is that part of the local board that's proposed in the current bill. If the Solvency Authority would be able to take up those five board positions within that bill, maybe that's some kind of compromise that could happen. But again, we haven't had those conversations. And having a whole new group of local elected officials put on a different board when we already have a board that's existing and has progress going forward, I'm not sure that's the best move at the moment. Those are my observations from the phone calls that I had. Do we have any other comments or questions? Go ahead. Ms. Nancy Ross.
Thank you. So I have taken blame a little more so from each person's comment, but that's how it always comes down. We have changed again and again and again our policies towards the solvency. How we're going to do it this year, how we're going to do it in 5 years. This group's going to step in, know what's going to be the state. We all stand to gain from something substantive happening, but none more than the people who live right there. The people who are suffering while we can't quite get our act together on who's on top and how we're going to get this taken care of. I appreciate I don't think there was a single person who spoke today that doesn't have the best interest of the people in the Salton Sea. But I am suspect that changing horses again is the best move forward. Thank you.
Well said. I would agree, Nancy. Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Betts.
So you can probably guess where I'm going to go with this with your comments. I'm sorry, Senator that's online, I don't know his name, I'm sorry.
Dan Reeves.
Representing Senator.
Yes. Senator.
I'm looking around it very much. I'm sorry, I keep track of all this. So I just want to share with you that all the cities in Coachella Valley have spent considerable time and gave consideration to a C2C solution and made a pretty simple request of $2 million for engineering to study a way to fill the salt sea back up with water. And had you ever heard that? And is there anything in Senate Bill 583 that provides funding for that or mentions it at all?
Well, sir, obviously there's been many discussions around the Salton Sea for many years. This bill is not attempting to refill the Salton Sea with water that, frankly, we don't know where it would come from. I know Senator Hueso, our predecessor, had a strategy around a canal from the Sea of Cortez. But no, we're not attempting to create an alternative route to refilling the sea. What we are attempting to do is take the Natural Resources Salton Sea Program that exists in Sacramento and take that staff and put them inside a conservancy that would be governed by local officials. That's the sum total of it. It's really not that confusing. It has no overlap with the authority, which I have to keep emphasizing.
In the interest of time, and just I'm trying to be rude, but the answer was no, there's nothing in there for that. That's not in the consideration.
No,
I've been saying it's not. So I would agree with Nancy that there's no sense changing the horse midstream. I'm not getting anywhere with the horse we got on filling the sea up, but I would really like to see one of these conversations where when everybody comes in here starts talking about that, maybe everybody just giving up. I see Chuck Parker isn't here anymore. Maybe he's giving up. I don't know. But it's a pretty simple request. I'm hearing $400 million here, you know, all this other money there, and nobody can come up with $2 million to simply study a proposal that I believe every city in this, in CBAG, has passed resolutions at their individual city councils supporting, and nobody wants to even give that consideration. We're just totally ignored on this. So I can't see any reason to support. And I thank Supervisor Perez for this thoughtful consideration of this and guidance on this issue. I agree with you.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I made several last meeting, but I'll just concur with comments and comment on Anthony's request that he indicated a support with amendments. I strongly believe we stick with an oppose until amended because there's so many unanswered questions and to continue to foster discussions to see how the collaboration could work without adding another layer and potentially some type of bond measure that goes on the ballot next year that will indicate a whole lot of money that we can't guarantee will come back to us.
I agree. You know, if there was a small amendment that could change this into something that was favorable here on both parties, then we might consider a support if amended. Yeah. But it seems like there's a lot of changes that need to happen here and a lot of conversations that need to happen between the two parties before we can move forward. Shatewa?
Thank you. I think that, here's an example, and we've all gone through this a number of times, where we literally have legislative exhaustion. There has been so many of these conversations over the years, and I appreciate what the supervisor is doing in trying to amend something so that it works. It's a hurdle. It's a challenge. There is no question about it. But until there are amendments that gets us back on track, we're going to continue to have these endless conversations. So consequently, I too am very much opposed to the present legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to make a motion to move forward with the recommendation to oppose Senate Bill 583 until we can further discussions and sort out details, find a better position collectively for us to move forward because of the path we all have for the Salton Sea.
Moment of second motion for the Pinta and a second from Beverly Hot Springs. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Blythe?
Yes.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Reed, for joining us. Thank you for the presentation. Really appreciate your efforts, but we do hope that you take into consideration the collaboration things that happen here. We'll move on to number seven, our information item, and move on to item number eight, public comments on non-agenda items. Do you have any public comments?
No, sir.
No public comments. We'll move on to number nine, announcements. Do you have any announcements?
No, I don't.
Okay, next energy and environment meeting is going to be Thursday, September 14th, and the next executive committee meeting, Monday, June 26th, at the General Assembly. Yes.
2 months without you, guys. What the heck are we all going to do? I'm on vacation.
Thank you all for all your input today.
Thank you.